It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both doing?
Pretty good.
Splendidly.
All right.
Hey, you asked.
Yeah, I know, and I got an honest answer. All right. Well, let's jump in. We got plenty to cover, and we should point out that if we have time at the end, we'll try and take a short email question or two. You can send those to dj@kexp.org. So it looks like in Pittsburgh this week, there were some protests, and the police really, really got into it.
Overreacted, yeah. Yes. There's a really, really good series of articles and photographs of this at the Pittsburgh Indie Media site, because you won't find out about it in your local daily papers.
And that's at pittsburghindiemedia.org.
Yeah. This was, what was the protest about? I forgot.
It was a counter-recruitment group called Organize Pittsburgh, and they've been doing various demonstrations at different weekends there at this recruitment center near the University of Pittsburgh. And they've been, you know, getting people together. They picket and occasionally block the entrance to the recruitment center, and, you know, a couple people will get arrested or whatever. This last weekend, what happened was it wasn't just a couple of people getting arrested. When folks sat down on the sidewalk to try to block the entrance to the recruitment center, the police hit them with pepper spray, tasers, metal batons, and they sicked canine units on them.
Yeah, it's really gruesome. There's a photograph on the website. We were talking about this before we went on the air. Police. It's a scene from Abu Ghraib. Police posing with their canine dog, menacing a protester.
The cop is staring directly at the camera with a big grin on his face, while his dog is barking at a protester seated peacefully on the sidewalk. It really is something you could have seen out of Abu Ghraib, and it's almost as if the cop posing for the picture is aware of that and thinks that that's neat. So, in addition, there's a photo on the web of a 67-year-old woman who was bit by one of the dogs. So, I encourage people to check it out, to read about it, and to donate to Organize Pittsburgh, which does good work, or to really, you know, email or call or complain to the mayor of Pittsburgh.
And write the local papers in Pittsburgh.
Because truly, I mean, sicking canine units on peaceful protesters, you know, dragging a woman from the sidewalk into the street and then hitting her repeatedly with a taser, that goes beyond the pale. I mean, the officers who actually did that should be fired, particularly the ones who sicked their dogs on protesters. The officer who ordered other officers to do that, he should be fired. And if that is Pittsburgh Police Department policy, then the chief of police should be fired.
Yeah, and the policies obviously should be changed as well.
Mm-hmm. It's really something that, you know, I haven't seen or heard about anything like this since. It brought up two scenes in my mind, scenes of the early civil rights protests in the Deep South, where white police sick dogs on black protesters, and in my mind, descriptions of what happened in Nazi Germany.
And you've got to ask why this is not a national story, why this is not something that you find in the mainstream media at all.
Well, and again, it also brings up the use of tasers specifically, although they use a lot of things there in Pittsburgh, but I know there's a big campaign from the manufacturer of tasers currently happening in the U.S. where they're going around pushing for, you know, using these in more police departments and trying to counter the current wave of citizens who are upset with them being used
as torture devices in
basically.
This case, instead of simply as a self-defense or to try to get...
Being applied directly to the skin, which is not how they're designed to be used.
Right.
All right. Moving along. Former presidential candidate Pat Robertson had some words this week for someone who was actually elected president.
Yes.
Yeah, and this incidentally backfired not only against Pat Robertson, who's since been forced to apologize, although, you know, how many times does Pat Robertson have to apologize before he actually gets his TV programs yanked? probably too many. He's had so many incidents like this in the past that it probably just doesn't mean anything to him. But it was interesting because it was an opportunity for the media in this country to review once again why Hugo Chavez is a bad president in Venezuela. And it was really a very striking media coverage of the controversy because it was almost as if the media was covering it as a he said she said type of thing. Yeah, Pat Robertson said a really bad thing, but on the other hand, maybe he has a point. It was really kind of appalling. At the same time, you've got to understand that that political elites in Washington, D.C. are really worried about this guy because he has had such an inspirational effect on other...
not Pat Robertson. They're worried about
Robertson,
Hugo Chavez,
yeah. has had such an inspirational effect on other grassroots democratic movements in South America and Central America and Latin America in general. The Ecuador strike that we talked about last week, for example, where the oil workers are in Ecuador were trying to force redistribution of some of the oil wealth to community improvements. That is taking direct inspiration from some of the Bolivarian principles that that Chavez is espousing. And you saw it with the Bolivian Revolution that happened a few months ago as well. Chavez's principles of trying to redistribute wealth to some of the poorer elements of Venezuelan society has a lot of fans in the rest of South America, and it worries Washington, D.C. quite a bit. This is where Pat Robertson is coming from. His opinions are shared by a lot of people in Washington, D.C., and that's the undercurrent of why you're seeing this media coverage that's much more deferential to him than it should be.
All right. Well, moving along, fuel economy. The Bush administration has proposed some changes.
Yeah, and some changes to what is called the CAFER, Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standards for light trucks. And supposedly light trucks is supposed to include sport utility vehicles and minivans and so forth. However, the new rules, one of the main problems with them is that they leave out the largest size of the SUVs, like the Hummer H2, for example, won't be covered at all, and there won't be any standards, any fuel economy standards for those big behemoths. Now, in addition,
actually, the standard is that they've got to get they have to burn a certain amount of fuel. They can't have any controls.
they have a minimum amount of fuel they have to burn.
Exactly.
Yeah. I see what you mean. Under the current system, the one where most vehicles are measured right, under which most vehicles are measured right now, and the automaker has to average the gasoline mileage of their entire fleet. So everything from their smallest subcompact car to their largest SUV, it all gets averaged out to a particular number. And if their average is below a certain level, then they're penalized. And of course, the penalties are small, but they're encouraged to bring it up to the average number. And this has been pretty hard for companies like Ford and General Motors to actually meet that number, surprisingly. When you think about it, they should be able to meet that fairly low number. However, they're having problems because they sell a huge number of SUVs in relation to their smaller cars. You were going to say, John?
Yeah, I was just going to say, even though that number is nowhere near what it should be.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So now they're going to change that system, and they're going to replace it with different targets for different size vehicles. However, there's still some wiggle room in there because if a manufacturer fails to meet the target for, say, heavy SUVs, not the heaviest class, but for, say, heavy SUVs, then they can exceed the target with their, say, subcompact cars, and everything's okay. They won't be penalized. There won't be any problem.
Sort of like pollution credits.
Yeah, a little bit like pollution credits. So that brings up the issue that critics have raised of what if they stop manufacturing like the middle classes, like light pickup trucks, which get far better gas mileage than larger pickup trucks, and they just manufacture hybrid vehicles or subcompact or compact cars and these enormous SUVs that still don't meet the standards. So that's one of the problems with these new rules. Plus, if you look at them, they're really not very strict at all. The larger SUVs, for example, they're going to have to increase their gas mileage by 1 to 2 gallons per mile, and that's by the year 2011. And even then, for the first 3 years of the for the first 3 years of the standards, auto manufacturers can opt to still do it the old way instead of the new way. So it really is a new standards that don't do very much at all.
And you've got to remember that these standards are in lieu of Congress having repeatedly declined to enforce any kind of emission controls.
Right, and for critics of the administration and for folks who are advocates for better gas mileage, who have been pushing for years for Congress and the government to impose stricter standards on larger vehicles.
Did you mean 1 or 2 miles per gallon as opposed to 1 or 2 gallons
per mile? 1 to 2 miles per gallon. Did I say it the other way around?
Still thinking of the Hummer.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about the Hummer and how much I hate him.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. Well, lots of news at the FDA, including they got a new insider working there.
Oh, they do. One of the number two men, there's a number one guy who's the head of the FDA, and then there's three sort of assistant heads. One of those guys left, and they've replaced him with a new guy. The new guy's name is Scott Gottlieb. He's a former Wall Street insider, and this marks probably the first time that an administration has snatched somebody directly out of the investment realm and put them into an oversight position at the FDA. Now, as a little reminder to folks of what the FDA does, the Food and Drug Agency reviews the applications for pharmaceutical companies that want to bring a new medicine on the market, and they decide whether or not that medicine is going to be safe. They look at all the trials and research, and they decide whether that medicine is going to be safe for the public. Now, we talked in the last couple weeks about the Vioxx scandal and how there's been this huge lawsuit and settlement one of the Vioxx lawsuits for, what was it, something like $220-some million, because the pharmaceutical company knew before they released the drug that it had the potential to give patients a much higher incident of heart attacks, even young and fairly healthy patients. And yet they released the drug anyway, and they withheld some of that data from their FDA application. Now, you can also say that the FDA is at fault here in the Vioxx scandal because of the push in recent years to speed up the drug approval system, the drug approval process at the FDA, to require less effort by the drug companies to do research and to force the folks reviewing the application at the FDA to do a quick and cursory look at all of the data instead of a deep and in-depth review. Now, this guy, Scott Gottlieb, he has been part of a group of Wall Street outsiders who came into the FDA in 2000 and 2003 and looked at the whole drug approval process and figured out ways, you know, on behalf of the Bush administration, figured out ways that you could make that process even faster. And so this is insane. The fact the Bush administration took one of these investment banker types and has now installed him at the FDA instead of someone who can do adequate oversight and knows the science, et cetera. They've got a guy in there now who's going to just make it much more easy for something like for a drug like Vioxx to get on the market and for more people to be injured as a result.
Yeah, they don't want to have science interrupt.
When they are injured, if the Bush administration has its way, we won't be able to sue either.
That's right.
All right.
It's not funny, but it is kind of.
And other happenings at the FDA this week.
Yeah. Ironically, there is one issue in which the FDA is requiring more studies, not fewer, and is requiring drug manufacturer jump through an amazing number of hoops, and that is for the morning after pill. Now, this is a prescription that has been available as a prescription since 1999, but the manufacturer, it's called a Plan B, is trying to get it available as an over-the-counter drug. And that's been in the works for a number of years. It's available in many other countries in that form. But the Bush administration, and particularly anti-abortion activists, are very much opposed to this. The FDA came back a few months ago and to the manufacturer's application for this and said, "Well, we want to make sure that the pill is not available to women under the age of 17 because it might encourage them to become more promiscuous if they knew that this pill was available over the counter, that they didn't have to get a prescription for it, they didn't have to get their parents' permission, they could just go to the drugstore and buy it." And so the manufacturer came back. And it also said that your study didn't include enough 16 and 17 year olds. The physiology of the pill was fine for that age, but they had to prove that a teenager could understand the instructions and apply the pill, take the pill properly. So the manufacturer came back and said, "Well, we can do it this way. We can make it available over the counter to women 17 years of age and older, and for younger than that, we can still require them to have a prescription." Well, the decision on this was supposed to be made by September 1st, and in fact, there was some funding that was attached to this that senators, in particular Hillary Clinton and Senator Patty Murray from Washington State, had agreed to loosen up under the stipulation that a decision on this would come by September 1st. The FDA this week instead decided to require more study. They punted on it, and they did it specifically because of the pressure from anti-abortion groups. And this is something people should be upset about, because this could make a huge difference in the lives of a lot of women.
Once again, women get the shaft. But, you know, I think it's kind of funny, too, that these same folks who said this, that, you know, we don't think teenagers would be able to understand the instructions, are probably people who have teenagers at home who download music to their iPods, can operate the VCR, can do video
games.
When
they can't operate the VCR.
They play their video games, they get, you know, they surf the internet. I mean, they do all these highly technical things that their parents probably can't figure out how to do. But I think it's funny, they think they can't read the instructions on how to take the morning after pill.
Kind of tangentially related, I saw this week, I didn't see all the details, that the SEC was suing a couple of the people at Merck. Did you catch that? Was I the only one that saw that?
Was that about doctors at Merck giving, or Merck soliciting information from doctors on research on various medicines and technologies? That was something. There was something about that in the Seattle Times. I also want to mention that Scott Gottlieb, this new guy at the FDA, has also argued in favor of doctors actually giving proprietary information out like that out to investment firms so that they can get the jump on new technologies.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so this thing that's seen as a conflict of interest and is something that might inhibit research, et cetera, is something that this guy is for.
Oh, well, you reminded me, this is totally on a tangent here, but since we're talking about youth and giving information out, the Seattle School District just put out the opt-out notices to students' parents, and they have till October 10th to actually get that back into the school district if students and or parents want to have their students' information taken out from being presented to the military databases. They got till October 10th.
Tell your kids' school. Tell them now.
Yep.
All right. Well, if nothing else on the national scene, maybe we can move over to international. And why don't we start that out with This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq. This week, the Constitution missed its third deadline. Parliament missed their third deadline to present a draft constitution.
They haven't started over yet, have they?
No, they haven't started over yet. But on Monday, the Shiites and Kurds came up with a draft that they said they could present to voters. And the Sunni minority on the Constitution Drafting Committee said, no, we are not going to go for this Constitution. But it was released to reporters anyway as the final draft. Now, Parliament has not voted on it. Parliament took a vote and said, let's wait 3 days to see if the Sunnis will get on board. Well, Thursday came and went, and the Sunnis had still said, no, we are not going to be for this draft. And now they're discussing maybe presenting this draft constitution to Parliament on Sunday. That would be tomorrow. and hoping that that Parliament will then vote on it unanimously. Now, there's not going to be a unanimous vote. I think what's going to happen is the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Kurds will say, well, we don't need Parliament to rubber stamp this. We've already drafted it. We're going to put it out for an October referendum. How they can do that, I don't know, because I think the wording in the original interim constitution is very vague on this point. They said that Parliament simply has to produce a draft of the constitution. It doesn't say that it has to be voted on by X number of members and approved by an X majority. So I think the Shiites and the Kurds are going to argue that their draft is the draft, and that's the one that's going to get presented to voters in October. Now, what is actually in this constitution? Because I got a copy of it, and I read the translated draft, and it's got some bombshells in it. Now, the first one is in Part 1, Article 2, and I'm going to read it to you. It's very short. It says, quote, Islam is the official religion of the state and is a basic source of legislation. No law can be passed that contradicts the undisputed rules of Islam. Okay, there you go. Religious state. Can anybody say religious state?
So much for women driving.
Oh, yeah. The second big bombshell is in Part 3, the judiciary. It says it sets up a Supreme Court as follows in Article 90, and this is again a direct quote, the Supreme Court will be made up of a number of judges and experts in Sharia, Islamic law, and law, whose number and member of selection will be defined by a law that should be passed by two-thirds of the Parliament members. So, okay, your second bombshell, religious court, okay, experts in Sharia law. And this constitution, this article shows that there are large portions of the constitution. You see this over and over again. This wording defined by a law that should be passed by two-thirds of the parliament members, or decided by parliament in a two-thirds majority. You see this over and over again. This constitution is not a final. It's not a final constitution. It's open-ended. It says that there's all these different issues that are going to be decided later by parliament. So it's obviously they put this together quickly, and it's not really a constitution for anything. It's just an open-ended draft of this is what we would like to do, but we weren't able to agree, so we're leaving it up to Parliament. Now, the next big bombshell, because there's another one, comes in Part 5, Authorities of the Regions. This is the part that really has the Sunnis upset, is this notion of federalism or decentralization of power. Now, it says in this section, with a simple 51% of votes in two or more, that it says that with a simple 51% of voters agreeing, two or more of the provinces can form a region, which can then write its own constitution, and that constitution can overrule the federal constitution in any kind of matter where the two conflict, as long as it doesn't have to do with federal powers like foreign policy, for example. Now, that also means that the regions can set up their own regional government and their own security forces, like the Kurdish Peshmerga or the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Their group, the Badr Brigades, their armed wing, can still exist as long as they're a regional militia.
Prescription for civil war.
It's a prescription for civil war, uh-huh. And it's meant to allow the Kurdish autonomous region to continue, but it also means that any group can set up their own little sub-region that can function almost like a nation. So it is giving, I think, way too much power, and I think the Sunnis are right, it's giving way too much power to regional authorities. Part 3 sets up an undefined council of union for representatives of the regions and provinces in order to, quote, examine bills related to regions and provinces. Again, this article is open to interpretation. I mean, it sets up this Council of Union that could, in effect, it could compete with the national parliament and could eventually supersede it if authority moves out from the center to all these different regions. So I think it's a dangerous track that they're on, and I think the Sunnis are right. There are other bad things in the draft, too. There's no article on women's rights at all, although there are articles protecting the welfare of children, the disabled, private property rights, commerce, even a clause on the protection and preservation of the family. They even have a clause in there protecting the environment, but no clause specifically on the rights of women. I think the only other thing that this Constitution is lacking is like an animal rights provision. But if it came down to a choice between women and donkeys, you can guess who would win out, right? The donkeys would get their claws. The women would be cut out. So that's also a problem with the Constitution.
And this from a country that was a leading voice in the Arab world for women's rights for 35 years.
Yeah. So who is actually for this constitutional draft and who's against? Well, for it's pretty clear. The Shiite Islamists are for it. They actually wrote most of it. And the Kurds are for it because they actually drafted the portions on federalism, on the regional governments. Now, who's against this? Obviously, the Sunnis are against it. They don't like the federalism and the fact that the Shiites could secede with most of the oil and the Kurds with the rest. They don't like the Islamic courts because most of the Shiite representatives on the Constitution Drafting Committee are secularists. They also don't like a provision that bans the Ba'ath Party and anyone who was a former member of it. Secularists, in addition, all secularists, Shiites, Sunni, Kurds, whatever, have a problem with the Islamic law that's enshrined in this Constitution. Women, most women are against this because of the lack of any kind of a clause on women's rights and the fact that they're losing the most liberal laws in the Middle East governing women's issues. Some Shiites, in addition, are against this. In fact, a very large number of Shiites who are followers of Muqtada al-Sadr, they're against the provision for regional powers because Muqtada al-Sadr doesn't look to Iran for support, and his supporters are mostly urbanites, and they're based all over the country, not just in the mostly Shiite south. So he is also against the Constitution. So really, when we look at it, the majority of Iraqis would be against the Constitution, and yet the Shiite Islamists and the Kurds want to take it to a vote for a national referendum. So we'll see. Either it'll go to national referendum and it'll be a struggle to get it passed and they'll have to start over, or there could be a civil war.
All right. And finally, just a couple minutes left, Gaza.
Yeah. Immediately after the withdrawal of settlers from the Gaza Strip, Ariel Sharon sort of he threw a little bone to the settlers again, and he said, well, we're going to expand the settlements in the West Bank, particularly the largest settlement near Jerusalem. He basically said, you know, just because we withdrew from the Gaza Strip doesn't mean we're not going to keep on expanding Jewish settlements in the West Bank.
In defiance of international law.
And I should note, too, that more new settlers, Israeli settlers, have entered the West Bank in the past year than have withdrawn from the Gaza Strip, something like 12 to 14,000 new settlers in the West Bank, Israeli settlers in the West Bank, versus the about 8,000 to 9,000 that were withdrawn from the Gaza Strip.
And can I just say parenthetically that I am really offended by the term settlers, because it really implies that there was nobody there, that they're pioneers, that somehow this land was unoccupied previously. These are people that are stealing land from families that have had it for generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the millions of Palestinians who live in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, as opposed to the few thousand Israeli squatters who have been entering the West Bank to claim to try to claim land from them. Now, in addition, Ariel Sharon is making some moves to control the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, which I think is a show of exactly how little freedom the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip will have under the new policy.
All right. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchek, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. We've got our endorsement issue for the primary election coming up. We are available wherever you find free periodicals, at bookstores and cafes and places like that. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org.
All right. And you guys got an email? How do people contact you directly? Sometimes they have questions just for you.
Editorial@eatthestate.org.
Thank you.